Ray flipped the cigar into a shrub and walked to his room. The night was cool, so he opened a window and listened to the cars as they left town and faded over the hills. Chapter 5. Every street had a story, every building a memory. Those blessed with wonderful childhoods can drive the streets of their hometowns and happily roll back the years. The rest are pulled home by duty and leave as soon as possible. After Ray had been in Clanton for 15 minutes, he was anxious to get out. The town had changed, but then it hadn't. On the highways leading in, the cheap metal buildings and mobile homes were gathering as tightly as possible next to the roads for maximum visibility. Ford County had no zoning whatsoever. A landowner could build anything with no permit, no inspection, no code, no notice to adjoining landowners, nothing. Only hog farms and nuclear reactors required approvals and paperwork. The result was a slash-and-build clutter that got uglier by the year. But in the older sections, nearer the square, the town had not changed at all. The long, shaded streets were as clean and neat as when Ray had roamed them on his bike. Most of the houses were still owned by people he knew. Or if those folks had passed on, the new owners kept the lawns clipped and the shutters painted. Only a few were being neglected. A handful had been abandoned. This deep in Bible country, it was still an unwritten rule that little was done on Sundays except go to church, sit on porches, visit neighbors, rest and relax the way God intended. It was cloudy, quite cool for May, and as he toured his old turf, killing time until the appointed hour, he tried to dwell on the good memories from Clanton. There was Dizzy Dean Park, where he had played Little League for the Pirates. And there was the public pool he'd swum in every summer except 1969, when the city closed it rather than admit black children. There were the churches, Baptist, Methodist, and Presbyterian, facing each other at the intersection of 2nd and Elm, like wary sentries, their steeples competing for height. They were empty now, but in an hour or so, the more faithful would gather for evening services. The square was as lifeless as the streets leading to it. With 8,000 people, Clanton was just large enough to have attracted the discount stores that had wiped out so many small towns. But here the people had been faithful to their downtown merchants, and there wasn't a single empty or boarded-up building around the square. No small miracle. The retail shops were mixed in with the banks and law offices and cafes, all closed for the Sabbath. He inched through the cemetery and surveyed the Atlee section in the old part, where the tombstones were grander. Some of his ancestors had built monuments for their dead. Ray had always assumed that the family money he had never seen must have been buried in those graves. He parked and walked to his mother's grave, something he hadn't done in years. She was buried among the Atleys at the far edge of the family plot, because she had barely belonged. Soon, in less than an hour, he would be sitting in the judge's study, sipping bad instant tea and receiving instructions on exactly how his father would be laid to rest. Many orders were about to be given, many decrees and directions, because the judge was a great man and cared deeply about how he was to be remembered. Moving again, Ray passed the water tower he had climbed twice, the second time with the police waiting below. He grimaced at his old high school, a place he had never visited since he had left it. Behind it was the football field, where Forrest Atlee had romped over opponents and almost became famous before getting bounced off the team. It was 5:20, Sunday, May 7th. Time for the family meeting. There was no sign of life at Maple Run. The front lawn had been cut within the past few days, and the judge's old black Lincoln was parked in the rear. But other than those two pieces of evidence, there was no sign that anyone had lived there for many years. The front of the house was dominated by four large round columns under a portico, and when Ray had lived there, these columns were painted white. Now they were green with vines and ivy. The wisteria was running wildly along the tops of the columns and onto the roof. Weeds choked everything, flower beds, shrubs, walkways. Memories hit hard, as they always did when he pulled slowly into the drive and shook his head at the condition of a once fine home. And there was always the same wave of guilt. He should have stayed, should have gone in with the old man and founded the house of Attlee and Attlee, should have married a local girl and sired a half-dozen descendants who would live at Maple Run, where they would adore the judge and make him happy in his old age. He slammed his door as loudly as possible, hoping to alert anyone who might need to be alerted. But the noise fell softly on Maple Run. The house next door to the east was another relic, occupied by a family of spinsters who had been dying off for decades. It was also an antebellum, but without the vines and weeds, and it was completely shadowed by five of the largest oak trees in Clanton. The front steps and the front porch had been swept recently. A broom was leaning near the door, which was open slightly. The judge refused to lock the house, and since he also refused to use air conditioning, he left windows and doors open around the clock. Ray took a deep breath and pushed the door open until it hit the doorstop and made noise. He stepped inside and waited for the odor to hit, whatever it might be this time. For years, the judge kept an old cat, one with bad habits, and the house bore the results. But the cat was gone now, and the smell was not unpleasant at all. The air was warm and dusty, and filled with the heavy scent of pipe tobacco. "Anybody home?" he said, but not too loudly. No answer. The foyer, like the rest of the house, was being used to store the boxes of ancient files and papers the judge clung to as if they were important. They had been there since the county evicted him from the courthouse. Ray glanced to his right, to the dining room where nothing had changed in 40 years, and he stepped around the corner to the hallway that was also cluttered with boxes. A few soft steps, and he peeked into his father's study. The judge was napping on the sofa. Ray backed away quickly and walked to the kitchen, where surprisingly there were no dirty dishes in the sink, and the counters were clean. The kitchen was usually a mess, but not today. He found a diet soda in the refrigerator and sat at the table trying to decide whether to wake his father or to postpone the inevitable. The old man was ill and needed his rest, so Ray sipped his drink and watched the clock above the stove move slowly toward 5 p.m. Forrest would show up, he was certain. The meeting was too important to blow off. He'd never been on time in his life. He refused to wear a watch and claimed he never knew what day it was. And most folks believed him. At exactly 5, Ray decided he was tired of waiting. He had traveled a long way for this moment, and he wanted to take care of business. He walked into the study, noticed his father hadn't moved, and for a long minute or two was frozen there, not wanting to wake him, but at the same time feeling like a trespasser. The judge wore the same black pants and the same white starched shirt he had worn as long as Ray could remember. Navy suspenders, no tie, black socks, and black wingtips. He had lost weight, and his clothes swallowed him. His face was gaunt and pale, his hair thin and slicked back. His hands were crossed at his waist and were almost as white as the shirt. Next to his hands, attached to his belt on the right side, was a small white plastic container. Ray took a step closer, a silent step, for a better look. It was a morphine pack. Ray closed his eyes, then opened them and glanced around the room. The roll-top desk under General Forrest had not changed in his lifetime. The ancient Underwood typewriter still sat there, a pile of papers beside it. A few feet away was the large mahogany desk left behind by the Attlee who had fought with Forrest. Under the stern gaze of General Nathan Bedford Forrest, and standing there in the center of a room that was timeless, Ray began to realize that his father was not breathing. He comprehended this slowly. He coughed, and there was not the slightest response. Then he leaned down and touched the judge's left wrist. There was no pulse. Judge Reuben V. Attlee was dead. Chapter 6. There was an antique wicker chair with a torn cushion and a frayed quilt over the back. No one had ever used it but the cat. Ray backed into it because it was the nearest place to sit, and for a long time he sat there, across from the sofa, waiting for his father to start breathing, to wake up, sit up, take charge of matters and say, "Where's Forrest?" But the judge was motionless. The only breathing at Maple Run was Ray's rather labored efforts to get control of himself. The house was silent, the still air even heavier. He stared at the pallid hands resting peacefully and waited for them to rise just slightly, up and down, very slowly as the blood began pumping again and the lungs filled and emptied. But nothing happened. His father was straight as a board, with hands and feet together, chin on chest, as if he knew when he lay down that this last nap would be eternal. His lips were together with a hint of a smile. The powerful drug had stopped the pain. As the shock began to fade, the questions took over. How long had he been dead? Did the cancer get him, or did the old man just crank up the morphine? What was the difference? Was this staged for his sons? Where the hell was Forrest? Not that he would be of any help. Alone with his father for the last time, Ray fought back tears and fought back all the usual tormenting questions of, why didn't I come earlier and more often, and why didn't I write and call, and the list could go on if he allowed it. Instead, he finally moved. He knelt quietly beside the sofa, put his head on the judge's chest, whispered, "I love you, Dad," then said a short prayer. When he stood, he had tears in his eyes, and that was not what he wanted. Younger brother would arrive in a moment, and Ray was determined to handle the situation with no emotion. On the mahogany desk, he found the ashtray with two pipes. One was empty. The bowl of the other was full of tobacco that had recently been smoked. It was slightly warm. At least Ray thought so, though he was not certain. He could see the judge having a smoke, while he tidied up the papers on his desk, didn't want the boys to see too much of a mess. Then when the pain hit, he stretched out on the sofa, a touch of morphine for a little relief. Then he drifted away. Next to the Underwood was one of the judge's official envelopes, and across the front he had typed, "Last Will and Testament of Reuben V. Attlee." Under it was yesterday's date, May 6th, 2000. Ray took it and left the room. He found another diet soda in the refrigerator and walked to the front porch, where he sat on the swing and waited for Forrest. Should he call the funeral home and have his father moved before Forrest arrived? He debated this with a fury for a while. Then he read the will. It was a simple one-page document with no surprises. He decided he would wait until precisely 6 p.m., and if Forrest hadn't arrived, he would call the funeral home. The judge was still dead when Ray returned to his study, and that was not a complete surprise. He replaced the envelope next to the typewriter, shuffled through some more papers, and at first felt odd doing so. But he would be executor of his father's estate, and would soon be in charge of all the paperwork. He would inventory the assets, pay the bills, help lead the last remnants of the Attlee family money through probate, and finally put it to rest. The will split everything between the two sons, so the estate would be clean and relatively simple. As he watched the time and waited for his brother, Ray poked around the study, each step watched carefully by General Forrest. Ray was quiet, still not wanting to disturb his father. The drawers to the roll top were filled with stationery. There was a pile of current mail on the mahogany desk. Behind the sofa was a wall of bookshelves, crammed with law treatises that appeared to have been neglected for decades. The shelves were made of walnut and had been built as a gift by a murderer freed from prison by the judge's grandfather late in the last century, according to family lore, which as a rule went unquestioned until Forrest came along. The shelves rested on a long walnut cabinet that was no more than 3 feet high. The cabinet had six small doors and was used for storage. Ray had never looked inside. The sofa was in front of the cabinet, almost entirely blocking it from view. One of the cabinet doors was open. Inside, Ray could see an orderly stack of dark green Blake and Son stationer's boxes, the same ones he'd seen as long as he could remember. Blake and Son was an ancient printing company in Memphis. Virtually every lawyer and judge in the state bought letterheads and envelopes from Blake and Son, and had been doing so forever. He crouched low and moved behind the sofa for a better look. The storage spaces were tight and dark. A box of envelopes without a top had been left sitting in the open door, just a few inches above the floor. There were no envelopes, however. The box was filled with cash. $100 bills. Hundreds of them packed neatly in a box that was 12 inches across, 18 inches long, and maybe 5 inches deep. He lifted the box, and it was heavy. There were dozens more tucked away in the depths of the cabinet. Ray pulled another one from the collection. It, too, was filled with $100 bills. Same for the third. In the fourth box, the bills were wrapped with yellow paper bands with $2,000 printed on them. He quickly counted 53 bands. $106,000. Crawling on all fours along the back of the sofa and careful not to touch it and disturb anybody, Ray opened the other five doors of the cabinet. There were at least 20 dark green Blake and Son boxes. He stood and walked to the door of the study, then through the foyer onto the front porch for fresh air. He was dizzy, and when he sat on the top step, a large drop of sweat rolled down the bridge of his nose and fell onto his pants. Though clear thinking was not entirely possible, Ray was able to do some quick math. Assuming there were 20 boxes and that each held at least $100,000, then the stash greatly exceeded whatever the judge had grossed in 32 years on the bench. His office of chancellor had been full-time, nothing on the side, and not much since his defeat 9 years earlier. He didn't gamble, and to Ray's knowledge had never bought a single share of stock. A car approached from down the street. Ray froze, instantly fearful that it was Forrest. The car passed, and Ray jumped to his feet and ran to the study. He lifted one end of the sofa and moved it 6 inches away from the bookshelves, then the same for the other end. He dropped to his knees and began withdrawing the Blake and Son boxes. When he had a stack of five, he carried them through the kitchen to a small room behind the pantry where Irene the maid had always kept her brooms and mops. The same brooms and mops were still there, evidently untouched since Irene's death. Ray swatted away spider webs, then set the boxes on the floor. The broom closet had no window and could not be seen from the kitchen. From the dining room, he surveyed the front driveway, saw nothing, then raced back to the study where he balanced 7 Blake and Son boxes in one stack and took them to the broom closet. Back to the dining room window, nobody out there, back to the study where the judge was growing colder by the moment. 2 more trips to the broom closet, and the job was finished. 27 boxes in total, all safely stored where no one would find them. It was almost 6 p.m. when Ray went to his car and removed his overnight bag. He needed a dry shirt and clean pants. The house was filled with dust and dirt, and everything he touched left a smudge. He washed and dried himself with a towel in the only downstairs bathroom. Then he tidied up the study, moved the sofa back in place, and went from room to room looking for more cabinets. He was on the second floor in the judge's bedroom with the windows up going through his closets when he heard a car in the street. He ran downstairs and managed to slip into the swing on the porch just as Forrest parked behind his Audi. Ray took deep breaths and tried to calm himself. The shock of a dead father was enough for one day. The shock of the money had left him shaking. Forrest crept up the steps as slowly as possible, hands stuck deep in his white painter's pants. Shiny black combat boots with bright green laces. Always different. "Forrest," Ray said softly, and his brother turned to see him.
"Hey, bro."
"He's dead." Forrest stopped and for a moment studied him, then he gazed at the street. He was wearing an old brown blazer over a red T-shirt, an ensemble no one but Forrest would attempt to pull off. And no one but Forrest could get by with it. As Clanton's first self-proclaimed free spirit, he had always worked to be cool, offbeat, avant-garde, hip. He was a little heavier and was carrying the weight well. His long sandy hair was turning gray much quicker than Ray's. He wore a battered Cubs baseball cap.
"Where is he?" Forrest asked.
"In there."
Forrest pulled open the screen, and Ray followed him inside. He stopped in the door of the study and seemed uncertain as to what to do next. As Forrest stared at his father, his head fell slightly to one side, and Ray thought for a second he might collapse. As tough as he tried to act, Forrest's emotions were always just under the surface. He mumbled, "Oh, my God," then moved awkwardly to the wicker chair where he sat and looked in disbelief at the judge.
"Is he really dead?"
he managed to say with his jaws clenched. "Yes, Forrest." He swallowed hard and fought back tears and finally said,
"When did you get here?"
Ray sat on a stool and turned it to face his brother.
"About 5, I guess. I walked in, thought he was napping, then realized he was dead."
"I'm sorry you had to find him," Forrest said, wiping the corners of his eyes.
"Somebody had to.
What do we do now?"
"Call the funeral home."
Forrest nodded, as if he knew that was exactly what you're supposed to do. He stood slowly and unsteadily and walked to the sofa. He touched his father's hands.
"How long has he been dead?" he mumbled.
His voice was hoarse and strained.
"I don't know. A couple of hours."
"What's that?"
"A morphine pack."
"You think he cranked it up a little too much?"
"I hope so," Ray said.
"I guess we should have been here."
"Let's not start that." Forrest looked around the room as if he had never been there before. He walked to the roll top and looked at the typewriter.
"I guess he won't need a new ribbon after all," he said.
"I guess not," Ray said, glancing at the cabinet behind the sofa.
"There's a will there if you want to read it, signed yesterday."
"What does it say?"
"We split everything. I'm the executor."
"Of course you're the executor."
He walked behind the mahogany desk and gave a quick look at the piles of papers covering it.
9 years since I set foot in this house. Hard to believe, isn't it?"
"It is."
"I stopped by a few days after the election, told him how sorry I was that the voters had turned him out. Then I asked him for money. We had words."
"Come on, Forrest, not now." Stories of the war between Forrest and the judge could be told forever.
"Never did get that money,"
he mumbled as he opened a desk drawer.
"I guess we'll need to go through everything, won't we?"
"Yeah. But not now."
"You do it, Ray. You're the executor. You handle the dirty work."
"We need to call the funeral home.
I need a drink."
"No, Forrest, please."
"Lay off, Ray. I'll have a drink any time I want a drink."
"That's been proven 1,000 times. Come on, I'll call the funeral home and we'll wait on the porch."
A policeman arrived first, a young man with a shaved head who looked as though someone had interrupted his Sunday nap and called him into action. He asked questions on the front porch, then viewed the body. Paperwork had to be done, and as they went through it, Ray fixed a pitcher of instant tea with heavy sugar.
"Cause of death?"
the policeman asked.
"Cancer, heart disease, diabetes, old age," Ray said.
He and Forrest were rocking gently in the swing.
"Is that enough?"
Forrest asked, like a true smartass. Any respect he might have once had for cops had long since been abandoned.
"Will you request an autopsy?"
"No,"
they said in unison. He finished the forms and took signatures from both Ray and Forrest. As he drove away, Ray said,
"Word'll spread like wildfire now."
"Not in our lovely little town."
"Hard to believe, isn't it? Folks actually gossip around here."
"I've kept him busy for 20 years.
"Indeed you have. They were shoulder to shoulder, both holding empty glasses.
"So what's in the estate?" Forrest finally asked.
"You want to see the will?"
"No, just tell me."
He listed his assets, the house, furniture, car, books, $6,000 in the bank.
"Is that all?"
"That's all he mentioned," Ray said, avoiding the lie.
"Surely there's more money than that around here," Forrest said, ready to start looking.
"I guess he gave it all away," Ray said calmly.
"What about estate retirement?"
"He cashed out when he lost the election. A huge blunder. Cost him tens of thousands of dollars. I'm assuming he gave everything else away."
"You're not going to screw me, are you, Ray?"
"Come on, Forrest. There's nothing to fight over."
"Any debts?"
"He said he had none."
"Nothing else?"
"You can read the will if you want."
"Not now."
"He signed it yesterday."
"You think he planned everything?"
"Sure looks like it." A black hearse from McGargle's funeral home rolled to a stop in front of Maple Run, then turned slowly into the drive. Forrest leaned forward, elbows on knees, face in hand, and began crying. Chapter 7 Behind the hearse was the county coroner, Thurber Foreman, in the same red Dodge pickup he'd been driving since Ray was in college, and behind Thurber was Reverend Silas Palmer of the First Presbyterian Church, an ageless little Scot who had baptized both Attlee sons. Forrest slipped away and hid in the backyard while Ray met the party on the front porch. Sympathies were exchanged. Mr. B.J. McGargle from the funeral home and Reverend Palmer appeared to be near tears. Thurber had seen countless dead bodies. He had no financial interest in this one, however, and appeared to be indifferent, at least for the moment. Ray led them to the study where they respectfully viewed Judge Attlee long enough for Thurber to officially decide he was dead. He did this without words, but simply nodded at Mr. McGargle with a somber, bureaucratic dip of the chin that said, "He's dead. You can take him now." Mr. McGargle nodded too, thus completing a silent ritual they'd gone through many times together. Thurber produced a single sheet of paper and asked the basics. The judge's full name, date of birth, place of birth, next of kin. For the second time, Ray said no to an autopsy. Ray and Reverend Palmer stepped away and took a seat at the dining room table. The minister was much more emotional than the son. He adored the judge and claimed him as a close friend. A service befitting a man of Reuben Attlee's stature would draw many friends and admirers and should be well planned.
"Reuben and I talked about it not long ago," Palmer said, his voice low and raspy, ready to choke up at any moment.
"That's good," Ray said.
"He picked out the hymns and scriptures, and he made a list of the pallbearers."
Ray hadn't yet thought of such details. Perhaps they would have come to mind had he not stumbled upon a couple of million in cash. His overworked brain listened to Palmer and caught most of his words. Then it would switch to the broom closet and start swirling again. He was suddenly nervous that Thurber and McGargle were alone with the judge in the study. "Relax," he kept telling himself. "Thank you," he said, genuinely relieved that the details had been taken care of. Mr. McGargle's assistant rolled a gurney through the front door, through the foyer, and struggled to get it turned into the judge's study.
"And he wanted a wake," the reverend said.
Wakes were traditional, a necessary prelude to a proper burial, especially among the older folks. Ray nodded.
"Here in the house?"
"No," Ray said instantly, "not here." As soon as he was alone, he wanted to inspect every inch of the house in search of more loot, and he was very concerned with the stash already in the broom closet.
How much was there?
How long would it take to count it? Was it real or counterfeit? Where did it come from? What to do with it? Where to take it? Who to tell? He needed time alone to think, to sort things out and develop a plan.
"Your father was very plain about this," Palmer said.
"I'm sorry, Reverend. We will have a wake, but not here."
"May I ask why not?"
"My mother." He smiled and nodded and said,
"I remember your mother."
They laid her on the table over there in the front parlor, and for 2 days the entire town paraded by. My brother and I hid upstairs and cursed my father for such a spectacle. Ray's voice was firm, his eyes hot. "We will not have a wake in this house, Reverend." Ray was utterly sincere. He was also concerned about securing the premises. A wake would require a thorough scouring of the house by a cleaning service and the preparation of food by a caterer and flowers hauled in by a florist. And all of this activity would begin in the morning.
"I understand," the Reverend said.
The assistant backed out first, pulling the gurney, which was being pushed gently by Mr. McGargle. The judge was covered from head to foot by a starched white sheet that was tucked neatly under him. With Thurber following behind, they rolled him out across the front porch and down the steps, the last Attlee to live at Maple Run. Half an hour later, Forrest materialized from somewhere in the back of the house. He was holding a tall, clear glass that was filled with a suspicious-looking brown liquid, and it wasn't iced tea.
"They gone?" he asked, looking at the driveway.
"Yes," Ray said. He was sitting on the front step, smoking a cigar. When Forrest sat down next to him, the aroma of sour mash followed quickly.
"Where'd you find that?" Ray asked. "He had a hiding place in his bathroom. Want some?"
"No." "How long have you known that?"
30 years.
A dozen lectures leapt forward, but Ray fought them off. They'd been delivered many times before, and evidently they had failed because here was Forrest sipping bourbon after 142 days of sobriety.
"How's Ellie?" Ray asked after a long puff. "Crazy as hell. The same."
"Will I see her at the funeral?"
"No, she's up to 300 pounds. 150 is her limit. Under 150 and she'll leave the house. Over 150 and she locks herself up."
"When was she under 150?
3 or 4 years ago. She found some wacko doctor who gave her pills. Got all the way down to 100 pounds. Doctor went to jail and she gained another 200. 300 is her max, though. She weighs every day and freaks out if the big needle goes beyond 3.
I told Reverend Palmer that we would have a wake, but not here, not in the house.
You're the executor.
You agree?
Sure.
A long pull on the bourbon, another long puff on the cigar.
"What about that hose bag who ditched you? What's her name?"
"Vicky."
"Yeah, Vicky. I hated that bitch even at your wedding."
"I wish I had."
"She still around?"
"Yep, saw her last week at the airport getting off her private jet."
"She married that old fart, right? Some crook from Wall Street?"
"That's him." "Let's talk about something else."
"You brought up women."
"Always a big mistake." Forrest slugged another drink, then said,
"Let's talk about money. Where is it?"
Ray flinched slightly and his heart stopped, but Forrest was gazing at the front lawn and didn't notice. "What money are you talking about, dear brother?" "He gave it away."
"But why?"
"It was his money, not ours."
"Why not leave some for us?"
Not too many years earlier, the judge had confided in Ray that over a 15-year period, he had spent more than $90,000 on legal fees, court fines, and rehab for Forrest. He could leave the money for Forrest to drink and snort, or he could give it away to charities and needy families during his lifetime. Ray had a profession and could take care of himself. "He left us the house," Ray said.
"What happens to it?"
"We'll sell it if you want. The money goes in a pot with everything else. 50% will go for estate taxes. Probate will take a year."
"Give me the bottom line."
"We'll be lucky to split $50,000 a year from now." Of course, there were other assets. The loot was sitting innocently in the broom closet, but Ray needed time to evaluate it. Was it dirty money? Should it be included in the estate? If so, it would cause terrible problems. First, it would have to be explained. Second, at least half would get burned in taxes. Third, Forrest would have his pockets filled with cash and would probably kill himself with it.
So I'll get $25,000 in a year, Forrest said.
Ray couldn't tell if he was anxious or disgusted. Something like that.
Do you want the house?
No, do you?
Hell no, I'll never go back in there.
Come on, Forrest.
He kicked me out, you know. Told me I'd disgrace this family long enough. Told me to never set foot on this soil again.
And he apologized. A quick sip.
Yes, he did. But this place depresses me. You're the executor, you deal with it. Just mail me a check when probate is over.
We should at least go through his things together.
I'm not touching them, he said and got to his feet. I want a beer. It's been 5 months and I want a beer.
He was walking toward his car as he talked.
You want one?
No.
You want to ride with me?
Ray wanted to go so he could protect his brother, but he felt a stronger urge to sit tight and protect the Attlee family assets. The judge never locked the house.
Where were the keys?
I'll wait here, he said.
Whatever.
The next visitor was no surprise. Ray was in the kitchen digging through drawers, looking for keys, when he heard a loud voice bellowing at the front door. Though he hadn't heard it in years, there was no doubt it belonged to Harry Rex Vonner. They embraced, a bear hug from Harry Rex, a retreating squeeze from Ray.
I'm so sorry, Harry Rex said several times.
He was tall with a large chest and stomach, a big messy bear of a man who worshipped Judge Attlee and would do anything for his boys. He was a brilliant lawyer trapped in a small town, and it was to Harry Rex that Judge Attlee had always turned during Forrest's legal problems.
When did you get here? He asked.
Round 5. I found him in his study.
I've been in trial for 2 weeks. Hadn't talked to him. Where's Forrest?
Gone to buy beer. They both digested the gravity of this. They sat in the rocking chairs near the swing.
It's good to see you, Ray.
And you too, Harry Rex.
I can't believe he's dead.
Nor can I. I thought he'd always be here. Harry Rex wiped his eyes with the back of a sleeve.
I'm so sorry, he mumbled. I just can't believe it. I saw him 2 weeks ago, I guess it was. He was moving around sharp as a tack, in pain but not complaining.
They gave him a year, and that was about 12 months ago. I thought he'd hang on, though.
Me too. Such a tough old fart.
You want some tea?
That'd be nice.
Ray went to the kitchen and poured 2 glasses of instant iced tea. He took them back to the porch and said, "This stuff isn't very good." Harry Rex took a drink and concurred,
"At least it's cold."
"We need to have a wake, Harry Rex, and we're not doing it here. Any ideas?" He pondered this only for a second, then leaned in with a big smile.
"Let's put him in the courthouse. First floor in the rotunda, lay him in state like a king or something."
"You serious?"
"Why not? He'd love it. The whole town could parade by and pay their respects."
"I like it."
"It's brilliant, trust me. I'll talk to the sheriff and get it approved. Everybody'll love it."
"When's the funeral?"
"Tuesday." "Then we'll have us a wake tomorrow afternoon. You want me to say a few words?"
"Of course. Why don't you just organize the whole thing?"
"Done. Y'all pick out a casket?"
"We were going in the morning."
"Due oak. Forget that bronze and copper crap. We buried Mama last year in oak, and it was the prettiest damn thing I'd ever seen. McGoggle can get one out of Tupelo in 2 hours. And forget the vault, too. They're just rip-offs. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Bury 'em and let 'em rot is the only way to go. The Episcopalians do it right."
Ray was a little dazed by the torrent of advice, but was thankful nonetheless. The judge's will had not mentioned the casket, but had specifically requested a vault, and he wanted a nice headstone. He was, after all, an Attlee, and he was to be buried among the other great ones. If anyone knew anything about the judge's business, it was Harry Rex. As they watched the shadows fall across the long front lawn of Maple Run, Ray said as nonchalantly as possible, "Looks like he gave all his money away."
"I'm not surprised, are you?"
No.
There'll be 1,000 folks at his funeral who were touched by his generosity. Crippled children, sick folks with no insurance, black kids he sent to college, every volunteer fire department, civic club, all-star team, school group headed for Europe. Our church sent some doctors to Haiti, and the judge gave us $1,000.
When did you start going to church?
2 years ago.
Why?
Got a new wife.
How many is that?
4. I really like this one, though.
Lucky for her.
She's very lucky.
I like this courthouse wake, Harry Rex. All those folks you just mentioned can pay their respects in public. Plenty of parking, don't have to worry about seating.
It's brilliant.
Forrest wheeled into the drive and slammed on his brakes, stopping inches behind Harry Rex's Cadillac. He crawled out and lumbered toward them in the semi-darkness, carrying what appeared to be a whole case of beer. Chapter 8. When he was alone, Ray sat in the wicker chair across from the empty sofa and tried to convince himself that life without his father would not be greatly different than life apart from him. This day was long in coming, and he would simply take it in stride and go on with a small measure of mourning. Just go through the motions, he told himself, wrap things up in Mississippi, and race back to Virginia. The study was lit by one weak bulb under the shade of a dust-covered lamp on the roll top, and the shadows were long and dark. Tomorrow he would sit at the desk and plunge into the paperwork, but not tonight. Tonight he needed to think. Forrest was gone, hauled away by Harry Rex, both of them drunk. Forrest typically became sullen and wanted to drive to Memphis. Ray suggested he simply stay there. Sleep on the porch if you don't want to sleep in the house, he said, without pushing. Pushing would only cause a fight. Harry Rex said he would, under normal circumstances, invite Forrest to stay with him, but the new wife was a hard ass and two drunks were probably too much.
Just stay here, Harry Rex said, but Forrest wouldn't budge.
Bullheaded enough when he was cold sober, he was intractable after a few drinks. Ray had seen it more times than he cared to remember, and sat quietly as Harry Rex argued with his brother. The issue was settled when Forrest decided he would rent a room at the Deep Rock Motel north of town.
I used to go there when I was seeing the mayor's wife 15 years ago, he said. It's full of fleas, Harry Rex said. I miss it already.
The mayor's wife? Ray asked.
You don't want to know, Harry Rex said.
They left a few minutes after 11, and the house had been growing quieter by the minute. The front door had a latch, and the patio door had a deadbolt. The kitchen door, the only one to the rear of the house, had a flimsy knob with a lock that was not working. The judge could not operate a screwdriver, and Ray had inherited this lack of mechanical skill. Every window had been closed and latched, and he was certain that the Attlee mansion had not been this secure in decades. If necessary, he would sleep in the kitchen where he could guard the broom closet. He tried not to think about the money. Sitting in his father's sanctuary, he mentally worked on an unofficial obituary. Judge Attlee was elected to the bench of the 25th Chancery District in 1959 and was reelected by a landslide every 4 years until 1991. 32 years of diligent service. As a jurist, his record was impeccable. Rarely did the appellate court reverse one of his decisions. Often he was asked by his colleagues to hear untouchable cases in their districts. He was a guest lecturer at the Ole Miss Law School. He wrote hundreds of articles on practice, procedure, and trends. Twice he turned down appointments to the Mississippi Supreme Court. He simply didn't want to leave the trial bench. When he wasn't wearing a robe, Judge Attlee kept his finger in all local matters, politics, civic work, schools, and churches. Few things in Ford County were approved without his endorsement, and few things he opposed were ever attempted. At various times he served on every local board, council, conference, and ad hoc committee. He quietly selected candidates for local offices, and he quietly helped defeat the ones who didn't get his blessing. In his spare time, what little of it there had been, He studied history and the Bible and wrote articles on the law. Never once had he thrown a baseball with his sons. Never once had he taken them fishing. He was preceded in death by his wife, Margaret, who died suddenly of an aneurysm in 1969. He was survived by two sons. And somewhere along the way, he managed to siphon off a fortune in cash. Maybe the mystery of the money would be solved over there on the desk, somewhere in the stacks of papers, or perhaps hidden in the drawers. Surely his father had left a clue, if not an outright explanation. There had to be a trail. Ray couldn't think of a single person in Ford County with a net worth of $2 million, and to hold that much in cash was unthinkable. He needed to count it. He had checked on it twice during the evening. Just counting the 27 Blake and Sons boxes had made him anxious. He would wait until early morning, when there was plenty of light and before the town began moving. He'd cover the kitchen windows and take one box at a time. Just before midnight, Ray found a small mattress in a downstairs bedroom and dragged it into the dining room to a spot 20 feet from the broom closet where he could see the front drive and the house next door. Upstairs, he found the judge's .38 caliber Smith & Wesson in the drawer of his night table. With a pillow that smelled of mildew and a wool blanket that smelled of mold, he tried in vain to sleep. The rattling noise came from the other side of the house. It was a window, though it took Ray minutes to wake up, clear his head, realize where he was and what he was hearing. A pecking sound. Then a more violent shaking. Then silence. A long pause as he poised himself on the mattress and gripped the .38. The house was much darker than he wanted, because almost all the light bulbs had burned out and the judge had been too cheap to replace them. Too cheap. 27 boxes of cash. Put light bulbs on the list first thing in the morning. There was the noise again, too firm and too rapid to be leaves or limbs brushing in the wind. Tap, tap, tap. Then a hard push or shove as someone tried again to pry it open. There were two cars in the drive, Ray's and Forrest's. Any fool could see the house had people in it. So whoever this fool was, he didn't care. He probably had a gun, too, and he certainly knew how to handle it better than Ray. Ray slid across the foyer on his stomach, wiggling like a crab and breathing like a sprinter. He stopped in the dark hallway and listened to the silence. Lovely silence. Just go away, he kept saying to himself. Please, go away. Tap, tap, tap. And he was sliding again toward the rear bedroom, with the pistol aimed in front of him. Was it loaded? He asked himself much too late. Surely the judge kept his bedside gun loaded. The noise was louder and coming from a small bedroom they had once used for guests, but for decades now it had been collecting boxes of junk. He slowly nudged the door open with his head and saw nothing but cardboard boxes. The door swung wider and hit a floor lamp, which pitched forward and crashed near the first of three dark windows. Ray almost began firing, but he held his ammo and his breath. He lay still on the sagging wooden floor for what seemed like an hour, sweating, listening, swatting spiders, hearing nothing. The shadows rose and fell. A light wind was hitting every branch out there, and somewhere up near the roof, a limb was gently rubbing the house. It was the wind, after all. The wind and the old ghosts of Maple Run. A place of many spirits, according to his mother, because it was an old house where dozens had died. They had buried slaves in the basement, she said, and their ghosts grew restless and roamed about. The judge hated ghost stories and refuted them all. When Ray finally sat up, his elbows and knees were numb. With time, he stood and leaned on the door frame, watching the three windows with his gun ready. If there had actually been an intruder, the noise evidently spooked him. But the longer Ray stood there, the more he convinced himself that the racket had been nothing but the wind. Forrest had the better idea. As grungy as the deep rock was, it had to be more restful than this place. Tap, 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 and he hit the floor again, stricken with fear once more. except this was worse because the noise came from the kitchen. He made the tactical decision to crawl instead of slide, and by the time he got back to the foyer, his knees were screaming. He stopped at the French doors that led to the dining room and waited. The floor was dark, but a faint porch light slanted feebly through the blinds and shone along the upper walls and ceiling. Not for the first time, he asked himself, what exactly was he, a professor of law at a prestigious university, doing hiding in the darkness of his childhood home, armed, frightened out of his mind, ready to jump out of his skin, and all because he wanted desperately to protect a mysterious hoard of cash he had stumbled upon? Answer that one, he mumbled to himself. The kitchen door opened onto a small wooden deck. Someone was shuffling around out there, just beyond the door, footsteps on boards. Then the doorknob rattled, the flimsy one with the malfunctioning lock. Whoever he was, he had made the bold decision to walk straight through the door instead of sneaking through a window. Ray was an Attlee, and this was his soil. This was also Mississippi, where guns were expected to be used for protection. No court in the state would frown on drastic action in this situation. He crouched beside the kitchen table, took aim at a spot high in the window above the sink, and began squeezing the trigger. One loud gunshot, cracking through the darkness, coming from inside and shattering a window, would no doubt terrify any burglar. Just as the door rattled again, he squeezed harder. The hammer clicked, and nothing happened. The gun had no bullets. The chamber spun, he squeezed again, and there was no discharge. In a panic, Ray grabbed the empty pitcher of tea on the counter and hurled it at the door. To his great relief, it made more noise than any bullet could possibly have done. Scared out of his wits, he hit a light switch and went charging to the door, brandishing the gun and yelling, "Get the hell out of here!" When he yanked it open and saw no one, he exhaled mightily and began breathing again. For half an hour, he swept glass, making as much noise as possible. The cop's name was Andy, nephew of a guy Ray finished high school with. That relationship was established within the first 30 seconds of his arrival. And once they were linked, they talked about football while the exterior of Maple Run was inspected. No sign of entry at any of the downstairs windows. Nothing at the kitchen door but broken glass. Upstairs, Ray looked for bullets while Andy went from room to room. Both searches produced nothing. Ray brewed coffee and they drank it on the porch, chatting quietly in the early morning hours. Andy was the only cop protecting Clanton at that time, and he confessed he wasn't really needed.
"Nothing ever happens this early Monday morning," he said. "Folks are asleep, getting ready for work."
With a little prodding, he reviewed the crime scene in Ford County. Stolen pickups, fights at the honky-tonks, drug activity in Lowtown, the colored section. "Hadn't had a murder in 4 years," he said proudly. "A branch bank got robbed 2 years ago." He prattled on and took a second cup. Ray would keep pouring it, and brewing it, if necessary, until sunrise. He was comforted by the presence of a well-marked patrol car sitting out front. Andy left at 3:30. For an hour, Ray lay on the mattress, staring holes in the ceiling, holding a gun that was useless. He fought sleep by plotting strategies to protect the money. Not investment schemes, those could wait. More pressing was a plan to get the money out of the broom closet, out of the house, and into a safe place somewhere. Would he be forced to haul it to Virginia? He certainly couldn't leave it in Clanton, could he? And when could he count it? At some point, fatigue and the emotional drain of the day overcame him, and he drifted away. The tapping came back, but he did not hear it. The kitchen door, now secured by a jammed chair and a piece of rope, was rattled and pushed, but Ray slept through it all. Chapter 9. At 7:30, sunlight woke him. The money was still there, untouched. The doors and windows had not been opened as far as he could tell. He fixed a pot of coffee, and as he drank the first cup at the kitchen table, he made an important decision. If someone was after the money, then he could not leave it, not for a moment. But the 27 Blake & Son boxes would not fit in the small trunk of his little Audi Roadster. The phone rang at 8. It was Harry Rex, reporting that Forrest had been delivered to the Deep Rock Motel, that the county would allow a ceremony in the rotunda of the courthouse that afternoon at 4:30, that he had already lined up a soprano and a color guard, and he was working on a eulogy for his beloved friend.
"What about the casket?" he asked.
"We're meeting with McGargle at 10, Ray answered.
"Good. Remember, go with the oak. The judge would like that."
They talked about Forrest for a few minutes, the same conversation they'd had many times. When he hung up, Ray began moving quickly. He opened windows and blinds so he could see and hear any visitors. Word was spreading through the coffee shops around the square that Judge Attlee had died, and visitors were certainly possible. The house had too many doors and windows, and he couldn't stand guard around the clock. If someone was after the money, then that someone could get it. For a few million bucks, a bullet to Ray's head would be a solid investment. The money had to be moved. Working in front of the broom closet, he took the first box and dumped the cash into a black plastic garbage bag. 8 more boxes followed, and when he had about $1 million in bag number 1, he carried it to the kitchen door and peeked outside. The empty boxes were returned to the cabinet under the bookshelves. 2 more garbage bags were filled. He backed his car close to the deck, as close to the kitchen as possible, then surveyed the landscape in search of human eyes. There were none. The only neighbors were the spinsters next door, and they couldn't see the television in their own den. Darting from the door to the car, he loaded the fortune into the trunk, shoved the bags this way and that, and when it looked as though the lid might not close, he slammed it down anyway. It clicked and locked, and Ray Attlee was quite relieved. He wasn't sure how he would unload the loot in Virginia and carry it from a parking lot down the busy pedestrian mall to his apartment. He would worry about that later. The Deep Rock had a diner, a hot, cramped, greasy place Ray had never visited, but it was the perfect spot to eat on the morning after Judge Attlee's death. The 3 coffee shops around the square would be busy with gossip and stories about the great man, and Ray preferred to stay away. Forrest looked decent. Ray had certainly seen him much worse. He wore the same clothes and he hadn't showered, but with Forrest that was not unusual. His eyes were red but not swollen. He said he had slept well but needed grease. Both ordered bacon and eggs.
"You look tired," Forrest said, gulping black coffee.
Ray indeed felt tired.
"I'm fine, couple hours of rest and I'm ready to roll."
He glanced through the window at his Audi, which was parked as close to the diner as possible. He would sleep in the damn thing if necessary.
"It's weird," Forrest said. "When I'm clean, I sleep like a baby. 8-9 hours a night, a hard sleep. But when I'm not clean, I'm lucky to get 5 hours. And it's not a deep sleep either."
"Just curious. When you're clean, do you think about the next round of drinking?"
"Always. It builds up like sex. You can do without it for a while, but the pressure's building, and sooner or later you gotta have some relief. Booze, sex, drugs, they all get me eventually."
"You were clean for 140 days.
141.
What's the record?"
"14 months.